Case number 25-7171. Amelia Quince and Thomas Carpenter, individually and on behalf of all others similarly situated, appellants versus Cathay International Inc. et al. Mr. Eiler for the appellants, Mr. Killian for the appellants.
Morning, counsel. Mr. Eiler, please proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I would. Your Honor, this is a straightforward appeal, I would say, on a 12B6 motion to dismiss here on de novo review. There's really two main issues, I think, for the court to be considering here. The first is the proper calculation of the regular rate for overtime pursuant to the D.C. Minimum Wage Act and the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act. The second issue is the failure to pay remuneration promised or owed pursuant to a contract or D.C. federal law and the interaction of that claim with the Service Contract Act. Your Honors, unless there is somewhere else you'd like to begin, I'd start with the D.C. wage payment collection law and the remuneration claim. Now, as we allege in our complaint, our clients are seeking compensation for a failure to timely pay them the correct wage rates, which they are owed under the D.C. wage payment collection law. This is a claim that arises under the rights created by the D.C. wage payment collection law with a remedy created under the D.C. wage payment collection law.
What section?
Specifically, Your Honor, it's Code Section 32-13013. It defines wages as including remuneration promised or owed pursuant to a contract for employment, a contract between an employer and another person, or pursuant to D.C. or federal law. This is a provision that was explicitly added by the D.C. Council in or about 2013 with, of course, the explicit imprimatur of Congress after the Johnson v. Waterproofing matter came out, which cited the Gronkowski's end run theory. Your Honor, that's the provision that our clients are suing under, as well is DC 32-1305B, which states that there is going to be a presumption that the remuneration promised is the federal prevailing wage here, a prevailing wage that would be entitled under the service.
Yes, Your Honor. The DC provision that you're invoking for your cause of action just incorporates federal law. And that seems problematic. This is a state. D.C. is treated like a state for preemption purposes. This is a state looking at the remedies available or not available under federal law, which here are administrative. They run through the agency. They do not include a private right of action. Mm-hmm. And the state's saying that's not good enough. We're giving you a private right of action.
Certainly, Your Honor. And I think the Wygod Court from the, I believe it's the Seventh Circuit. Thank you, Your Honor. Addresses this point.
That's a good case for you, except that in Wygod, the state is, the plaintiffs are just invoking generally applicable tort and fraud law. And that is much less direct in its interference mm-hmm. with the federal scheme that we have here.
Well, Your Honor, insofar as, and I think to address that question maybe head on, I don't know that there's necessarily an exclusive federal scheme that's being interfered with here. And certainly, I would not agree that there's any form of preemption by the Service Contract Act. I think numerous courts have addressed the preemption. And certainly, I think there's no real dispute that there's any express or explicit preemption from the Service Contract Act. That only leaves implied preemption.
No, right. It's frustrating the operation of the federal scheme. Mm-hmm. Where the federal scheme, it's reticulated and it's administratively focused. I mean, let's say D.C. came in mm-hmm. and said, the D.C. law says for any violation of this federal statute and only this federal statute, the plaintiff has a cause of action to recover tenfold the damages. Mm-hmm. No one's going to run through that administrative scheme.
Your Honor, I think
you're going to run into state court and No one's going to the secretary.
And I think the appropriate question to ask there would be whether or not the remedy that the Congress made in the federal statute in that scenario, is that an exclusive comprehensive remedy? Mm-hmm. If a state determines that they're going to attach or equate, for instance, here, the definition of wages is equated to the prevailing wage rate. Not necessarily is it saying, you know, if there's a violation of the wage setting.
I'm sorry, decision, say that again. What's equated?
The definition of wages is equated to whatever the prevailing wage is.
Under federal law.
Under federal law, like the Davis-Bacon Act, the Service right. Contract Act.
But what's bugging me is that the conduct element of the state claim is just pegged to the federal standard.
Certainly, Your Honor.
So this looks like state enforcement of the federal standard as opposed to just a freestanding, generally applicable tort claim or something that happens to overlap.
Well, Your Honor, I think then the question to ask is whether, and I think as you hinted at, is there some form of obstacle preemption? There's some form of conflict preemption. Right. And I don't think that there is. I think CTS Corp, we cited in our reply brief, noted that where the basic purpose of the act is being forwarded by the state remedy, then that is evidence at the very least to suggest to us that there is not going to be a finding of conflict preemption. And here, where the basic purpose of the SCA, as we see in Call Henry, we see in Saavedra, is to stop the subsidizing of standard pay for employees of service contractors, a collection law that permits service contract employees to not be underpaid, I think forwards the basic purpose of the SCA. I don't think
sounds
that there's any conflict.
A little bit like just a flabby invocation of the long-renounced canon that remedial statutes are broadly construed.
And I don't think that that's necessarily... I think we have to focus on the basic purpose because we need to understand what it is the basic purpose of the SCA is to see what is conflicting or not conflicting with it. And we understand as well from the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals and the Amaya decision that statutes like the FLSA and the Davis-Bacon Act and the SCA can coexist where they're where they don't conflict, they're mutually supplementary. And Your Honor, as well, I would note that I think the courts have a duty that where the statutes are meant to be read in harmony and as a cohesive whole. I don't believe that in any reading of the SCA that there is a direct conflict with the there's a direct conflict by preemption. Sorry, Your Honor.
There's no impossibility preemption. I'll give you that. But the federal scheme seems to depend on employees going to the secretary, right? And
well,
saying we're being underpaid.
Depend on, I think, is...
So the frustration would be nobody does that because you can either do that and who knows what happens, or you have this... super lucrative 4x recovery.
And Your Honor, I think this is, I think, some of the questions that were being asked by the miscellaneous service worker case where they said who will, you know, exercise their administrative remedy if there's faster relief in court. I think this is also a question that the Supreme Court asks time and again when it addresses these ex parte Young cases. And in miscellaneous service worker, where I think that very question was addressed, the Hawaii, I think it was a Hawaii case, nine out of the Ninth Circuit, there were unpaid wage claims there as well. Those claims were not dismissed because of some exclusive administrative remedy or some frustrating of the administrative purpose. And miscellaneous service workers, they said, you can't sue under the SCA. We were applying Court v. Ash, and there's no private right of action here. The Hawaii, I believe Hawaii, unpaid wage claims are being dismissed because there's a failure to state. I
can't see how D.C. law has anything to do with this case. Is there a provision that you cite that under D.C. law that would that tells you how to calculate overtime?
Yes, Your Honor, that would be the D.C. Minimum Wage Act. The D.C. Minimum Wage Act, and I can address maybe the first issue I'd flagged about the proper calculation of the regular rate, Your Honor. The D.C. Minimum Wage Act defines the regular rate synonymous.
What section?
I believe it's D.C. DC Code 32-1003, I believe. If you give me just a moment, Your Honor.
I think it's 1002.
It might be 1002. It defines the regular rate synonymously
It would be helpful if you give the section rather than talking in generalities about a particular DC law.
It's DC Code Section 32-10027, defining the regular rate near synonymously with the FLSA's definition of 29 U.S.C. 207E. Your Honor, there's a sort of equivalent there for the most part.
It doesn't tell you how to calculate it. I mean, that's the question here, isn't it? Whether in-kind payments should be included in the regular rate.
And, Your Honor, I think...
Tell me where D.C. law has anything to say about that.
Whether in-kind payments, as in bona fide fringe benefit payments to a third party or cash paid in lieu. Cash paid in lieu, Your Honor. It's sort of an interstitial issue. So, first, I would say D.C. Code 32-1003 requires that there be a rate not less than one-half times the regular rate at which an employee is employed. That's the overtime compensation. That regular rate term is then defined by DC Code 32-10027, which looks to the FLSA. And what the FLSA does not say, what it says is all remuneration for employment is included in the regular rate, except for the statutorily authorized exceptions.
You're now interpreting federal law, which is, I go back to my question, DC law doesn't tell you anything about how to calculate the regular rate.
Well, certainly, Your Honor.
It just says do it or make it the same as the Fair Labor Standards Act.
And I would disagree with that, Your Honor. I think that the D.C. Minimum Wage Act simply equates or takes, copy and pastes the definition of the FLSA's regular rate, the defining federal regulation on overtime premium compensation in this country, the 29 U.S.C. 207E. It's rather than restate every single provision of 29 U.S.C. 207E, it simply says, you know, we define it similarly, not with every exception.
I thought for this issue, I realize we've shifted to this issue, but on this issue, I thought that everybody agreed that what the resolution turns on is the language of 6707E. Everybody's talking about whether there's a comma and whether there's a that and whether
this, yes, Your Honor.
Isn't it all about 6707E?
So in the first instance, I would say, Your Honor, is that the regular rate is clear. And I'll get to 6707E, which is, I believe, important because what the lower court below and what appellees are arguing is that in determining any federal, what 6707E states, Your Honor.
Can I just, before you get to that?
Yes, Your Honor.
You started with the second of your two questions.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I'm just trying to track Judge Randolph's question about where the federal law is. For purposes of your second question, which I've been discussing
with
you, there is a state cause of action for four times the damages flowing from failure to pay the wage required by federal law. That's how the DC law works, right?
Yes, that's one of three avenues.
And then on your first question, it's just, as the chief judge said, it's just a pure question of
the statutory interpretation. The
interpretation of the federal statute. Do I have that right?
I think so, Your Honor. And just to cut right to it, Section 6707E, there
back
is...
Back on the first issue. Now we're on
back,
the first
back issue. On the first issue. Thank you, Your Honors. Section 6707E states that, and to paraphrase, though, if I can find my citation here, I'll take Appellee's argument. There's three clauses. In determining any overtime pay to which a service employee is entitled under federal law, the regular or basic hourly rate of pay of the service employee does not include any fringe benefit payments computed under this chapter, which are excluded from the definition of regular rate under Section 7E of the Fair Labor Standards Act. Now, I think multiple courts have addressed this. I think at least seven district courts to date, two courts after the lower court ruled on this issue, including the Miranda court out in the California, another federal court, which determined that the plain reading of this statute is that it sets out the entire universe of fringe benefits paid under the or computed under this chapter, Service Contract Act, and then narrows that to only exclude from the regular rate those which are excluded from the definition of regular rate under the Fair Labor Standards Act. That's what 6707E plainly says.
I don't see how it's, you may be right, but for the life of me, I don't see how it's plain.
And Your Honor,
a comma and a which would be plainly non-restrictive, and a that would be plainly restrictive. This is sloppy drafting, which creates an ambiguity.
And Your Honor, even assuming that it is ambiguous, the appellees and the district court's reading is not the best reading. And there's a clue right there.
Why?
In the non-restrictive. As the appellee's own cited authority, the Supreme Court in Nebraska noted that a non-restrictive clause can be grammatically removed from the sentence without, in fact, changing the essential meaning of the sentence. So if what we're reading is clause three is non-restrictive, then it's meaningless. And that's what the Miranda court found as well. The Miranda court found that if they had just put a period right after computed under this chapter, the meaning would be the same as it is currently written.
Why there's a lot of technical stuff about commas and that's and which is and everything. If you just step back for a second and ask what's the provision trying to do and how does it fit within the larger statutory context, it seems complicated to me to reach the conclusion that you want to reach. For the simple reason that why would we assume that Congress wanted to draw a distinction between what it itself determined as an equivalent cash payment and the extension of a fringe benefit?
Well, Your Honor,
they were supposed to be on par. Mm-hmm. If they're supposed to be on par, then why would one have a pretty dramatically different consequence for purposes of
calculation
of overtime?
Apologies, Your Honor. I think they're not on par, and I'll answer this final point. I don't think they are on par. If we look at 29 U.S.C. 207E, cash paid in lieu of benefits, cash given directly to an employee, not given to a third party or a bona fide fringe benefit plan, that is included in the regular rate. The only fringe benefit payment that is excluded from the regular rate is 207E4, which are those a fringe benefit payment that's given irrevocably to a third party pursuant to some sort of fringe benefit
plan.
Trustee
or something.
Yeah. Exactly. That's, yes, Your Honor. 401k of some form like this. But a cash payment given directly to the employee, that is not excluded from the regular rates definition in the FLSA. Your Honors, I'm out of time. I'll be back for rebuttal. Are there any questions I can answer before I leave?
Sure. We'll give you a little time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Killian.
Good morning, Chief Judge Srinivasan. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Brian Killian on behalf of the Appellee CACI. District Court correctly concluded that the overtime and the wage claims that the appellants have raised founder on the statutory text of the Service Contract Act. I would like to start where my friend on the other side concluded with the fringe benefit payment issue, and then I'll move to the new wage determination issue, if that's okay with the court. Okay, so 6707E may not be the most artfully written statute in the code, but looking at everything that Congress gave us, from the text to the context, the canons of interpretation, and what the Service Contract Act is trying to do, the Department of Labor's original 60-year-old contemporaneous interpretation is the best interpretation of what 6707E does. And to be specific, what it does is it says that federal overtime formulas do not include fringe benefit payments that are allowed under this statute, and then it clarifies in the which clause that fringe benefit payments are excluded from the Fair Labor Standards regular rate. Now, there's no dispute between the parties that the required fringe benefits that the SCA requires when in kind are already excluded from the Fair Labor Standards Act. And so what 6707E does is extend the pre-existing exclusion to cover this new thing, this cash in lieu of fringe.
I may have misheard you. If we didn't have a government contract here, And these were people that were working in the private sector. They'd be governed. The pay would be has to be consistent with the Fair Labor Standards Act.
That's correct.
Right. The Fair Labor, but they, if they got an in-kind payment, it would be counted as part of the regular rate because it's not excluded.
The in-cash would, Your Honor. That's right.
In cash for all private
That's right.
contractors and private employees. So by a parity of reasoning, one could say that what Congress wanted to do was put these people who are working government contracts on a par with those down the street who are putting a building up. If they get in-kind payments, it's included in the regular rate. So these people, if they get the government contract workers, if they get in-kind payments, then it's included in the rate.
I understand Your Honor's question. I think there are two significant responses. Number one is Congress would not need to have written 6707E to have accomplished that, because that was the background law and remains the background law for everyone. And this feeds into an argument that I can fold back to in a moment, because I want to get to the second response to your question of why the restrictive interpretation renders 6707E a nullity. It renders it completely superfluous. But there is a meaningful difference, Judge Randolph, between an ordinary employer who I'll call them a non-SCA employer who's providing cash in lieu of fringe and an SCA employer who provides cash in lieu of fringe. And that's because cash in lieu of fringe under the Service Contract Act is tightly regulated. There's a ceiling and a floor. You have to provide that specific amount. You have to provide the specific regular wage as well. That's what these wage and benefit determinations that DOL issues regularly say. They provide numerical, precise numbers. With non-SCA employers, the risk is that an employer will see this as a loophole around overtime. Instead of $20 an hour in wage plus five in fringe, I'll just pay him $25 an hour in fringe. And all of a sudden, the overtime, 1.5 times the regular rate, is a nullity.
What year was the SCA passed?
I believe 64.
64. At that time, there was some controversy about whether the Fair Labor Standards Act applied to government contractors. And so you ask, you say there was no reason for Congress to pass it. The reason is that because of that controversy, they wanted to be sure that the Fair Labor Standards Act had some bite for government contractors.
I'm not aware of that controversy, Judge Randolph, but I do think...
Well, take a look at a case that was decided by this circuit in 1972, and it was Carter versus the Panama Canal Corporation.
Okay. So I'll
dealt with portal to portal, but necessarily dealt with overtime.
Okay. I do think, though, that there's another indication in the statutory text that Congress did not simply have the purpose here of affirming application of the Fair Labor Standards Act. And that is that the act, on their interpretation, as I said, 6707C maybe does actually nothing. And what we know from the title is that it was attempt to exclude fringe benefit payments. Congress wants to exclude something, and yet their interpretation excludes nothing. And that's the nullity problem that comes from their interpretation, from that restrictive interpretation.
That's a great argument for you if the FLSA were the only federal overtime statute. But it's not. So one way of understanding this is what they were saying is take the FLSA rule and apply it to every other overtime formula in federal law. And it's, you know, maybe I think weirdly narrow, but it's not surplusage.
Well, but the fact that there are hard, that these in-cash payments are not on the list of excluded, they're not on the list of exclusions, I should say, from the regular rate under the Fair Labor Act. That also is what renders this a nullity. So on their restrictive interpretation, it says, and I'm going to paraphrase, but just to make my point, for all federal overtime statutes, exclude all fringe benefit payments on a list of exclusions that don't include fringe benefit payments. And that is a really circumlocutious way of saying don't do anything because they're not on the list.
But when you imply the comma in there and read the which clause non-restrictively.
Let me just make sure I'm tracking this. Assume the which is a that.
The that,
which right. Which is your reading.
Right. So.
So am I just want to make sure I'm reading it the way you would.
So it says the regular basic rate.
Take the exclusion from the regular rate under the FLSA, right, which is what the which clause is talking about.
Right.
And apply it to any other benefits payments under these narrow statutes that apply to workers.
So this I think what you say is the regular basic rate
right.
does not include any fringe benefit payments. That, I'm going to use the word that, yep. are excluded from the definition of regular rate. But the problem is there are no fringe benefit payments excluded from the definition of regular rate, right? So that's another aspect of the nullity here. It's essentially a cross-reference to a list of exclusions that don't include fringe benefit payments because those are a novel creation of the Service Contract Act, Section 7602 sub B. And so the way DOL has understood this is that...
mechanics... the pre-SCA FLSA background rule was if the employer cuts a check to the employee,
it's wage.
It's counted. If the employer cuts a check to the pension fund or whoever, it doesn't count.
That's exclusion four, yeah, primarily that we're dealing with here. Yes, exactly. But the point is these fringe benefit payments, which are the new sort of cash in lieu of fringe that you're allowed to pay under this statute, aren't on there. So at the risk of repeating myself,
They're not under the FLSA
exception
they count
four.
As regular income.
Right. But they're, if it says, if the word which is of that, mm-hmm. the regular rate does not include any of these special payments that are excluded. There are none that are excluded. So that's what sort of made it stillborn, right? It's saying you may exclude any of these fringe benefit payments that are excluded. None are excluded because it only covers what's excluded is the in-kind, not these new in-cash payments. And so on the restrictive interpretation, not only does 6707E...
When you say none are excluded within the compass of the SCA?
Of the FLSA.
Of the F. But the FLSA...
The cash payments aren't excluded from the FLSA.
Right. Under the FLSA system, the cash payments are treated as
wage. Right. Right. Yeah. So what I'm trying to say is I think on the restrictive interpretation... What you have here is a long series of instructions. You know, any federal overtime law, you got to determine what the regular rate is. On this theory, you can take these new types of payments, these new fringe benefit payments under Section 7602, and you may exclude them if they are excluded under the FLSA, but they aren't. They never have been. The only thing that's excluded are the in-kind benefits. And so these new cash payments, this is essentially a long instruction telling you to do nothing because it's cross-referencing a list that doesn't contain these fringe benefit payments. And thus, the way to reconcile that so that this actually does something is saying these new fringe benefit payments are excluded. We're announcing an exclusion under any potential federal overtime law, and we are inserting them into the exclusions that already exist under the Fair Labor Standards Act so that when states, for instance, like D.C., expressly incorporate the Fair Labor Standards Act and its exclusions, they will pick these up as well. And so that's where Judge Friedrich...
creates a surplusage problem for your position, I think.
I don't think it does, because
on your view, the clause preceding the which or the that is doing a lot of work, right? It's
right
saying it's making a statement about the regular rate and the basic rate. And those are terms of art. They're incorporated in the FLSA.
And other statutes.
And if that first clause does all that work, it's going to operate on the FLSA, it's going to operate on any statute that incorporates the FLSA, and it's going to operate on any statute that uses the term of art.
That's right. So I think Judge Katz is...
So what is the which?
On our interpretation, it's a Venn diagram with a really significant overlap, to be sure. The Venn diagram on sort of the one big circle is all the
two circles.
Yeah, all the federal overtime laws, right. The FLSA, the biggest, and then we cited a bunch of the others in our brief that variously use the word regular rate and basic rate as sort of their foundation of the formula and saying whatever formula you're using under any of these statutes, you don't count these cash benefit payments. Now, the which clause says looking specifically at the FLSA only, these new cash payments come within the relevant exclusion. Now, the reason that does something additional, Judge Katz, is that at the time of the SCA and to this day, many states expressly incorporate the FLSA's definition of regular rate and its exclusions. And so this is a way of essentially announcing to states that if you're going to piggyback on the federal standard, as many had done, these exclusions are now slightly broader because they include the cash payments that we've just created in the new Service Contract Act. And so it has the consequential effect of not just making it a rule for federal overtime, but it's a way of expanding that rule into states that opt to follow the Fair Labor Standards Act. And so, you know, Congress could not
seeing if the state opts to follow the FLSA formula. And if SCA modifies the SCA formula, if SCA modifies the FLSA formula in the way that you're suggesting, state calculation will be so modified.
Correct. And that's what the which clause does.
No, because, even without the which.
No, because because clause one says in determining overtime entitled under federal law. So the first clause isn't purporting to articulate a rule for state overtime laws. It really is saying when you're doing it on the federal laws, whatever they are,
the state law is going to just operate on the FLSA.
But the way the states do it is they do it by expressly referencing, cross-referencing and incorporating like DC does here, the DC provision that my friend on the other side cited, 32-1002 sub 7, says our regular rate is the FLSA's regular rate, including exceptions 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And right, so they do it not just, they do it through an express cross-reference. And this which clause is, I think, the way Congress accommodated that and expanded it into states that choose to follow the FLSA rather than simply articulating a rule of federal overtime law. Which is what the first two clauses do. So that's why it's a Venn diagram with a lot of overlap. It's a lot of overlap, but they each do a little bit different.
Complete overlap, but maybe the explanation is belt and suspenders drafting. It's giving an extra degree.
I don't resist that either, yeah. Judge Katz has said a little bit of belt and suspenders is this moderate type of redundancy that we often tolerate in statutory interpretation because Congress wants to be sure that its purpose is accomplished. But insofar as some judges and district courts have resisted this, it's because they haven't understood the state law implications of the non-restrictive interpretation and that it carries through to the states like DC that voluntarily adopt the FLSA's definition of regular rate and its exclusions.
So just one other canon, which I thought might cut against you, which is the elephants in mouse holes principle. If you read this consistent with your adversary's approach, it's very narrow, right? It's just
doesn't do anything.
It's just saying take the FLSA formula as modified and apply that to other overtime statutes.
That's not what they've said, but I take your point. That's a third interpretation, I think, Judge Cassis.
Right, well, just spot me that for the question. Under your interpretation, that first clause is changing the FLSA is the pre-existing statute. It's the mother of all overtime statutes. It's the background rule. And it has this basic distinction. If you pay the employee, that counts. If you pay the third party provider, it doesn't. On your reading, this statute fundamentally changes that basic structural feature of the background law.
But only for service contractors.
And that is arguably a little bit of an elephant in the mouse hole of a, sub-provision of something that's titled enforcement in this more specialized statute?
So two responses. The subprovision has its own title, which is exclusion of fringe benefit payments. We're trying to figure out what is actually excluded, number one. Number two, it's just not, I don't think this is an elephant. The service contractors are a pretty small portion of the overall scope of employers who are covered by the Fair Labor Standards Act. And as Judge Randolph alluded in his response before, government contractors may have been in this position of not really knowing this, their suitability of the Fair Labor Standards Act. My point is this does not change the rule for non-SEA employers, which is what 99.59% of employers in the United States. So no radical change occurred.
In 1965, when this SCA was passed, Congress was holding hearings about whether the Fair Labor Standards Act should be applied to government contractors. It was, and that those hearings resulted 1 year later in the passage of the amendments to the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1966. So getting back to the point, I mean, you think this was aimed at state laws and so on and so forth. I don't think it was at all. I think it was just plugging a loophole that Congress was holding hearings about in 1965.
Well, Judge Randolph, I guess my only other response, and I come at this without enough preparation to answer it fully, but the SCA, I would just point out, is one of three major statutes governing the universe of federal contractors. In addition to the Service Contract Act, there's the Davis-Bacon Act, which covers government construction contracts. And then there's a third act, whose name is escaping me right now, that covers government supply contracts. They all have sort of variations on this. And the Service Contract Act really was the latest of these three. And so some of this stuff had been percolating and existed, I believe, under the Davis-Bacon Act. There's a type of cash in lieu of fringe that predated this by many, many years. So unless the court would like to keep talking about fringe benefit payments.
I do. I want to have one more question about fringe benefit payments. Sorry, you were going to switch to the other issue.
I'm here to answer your Honor's questions.
Let me just ask you one just kind of high-level question about this. So am I understanding the context right in that under the FLSA, outside the SEA, so just assume it's pure FLSA context, then when we're talking about fringe benefits and whether the amount of the fringe, the value of the fringe benefit gets factored into the base rate for purposes of figuring out the overtime rate, that if it's a cash payment, it does.
It's just cash. It's just wage, yeah.
If it's a cash payment, it's treated as wage, even if it's cash in lieu of a fringe benefit.
Yeah, because that's the loophole, right? I would, instead of paying my employees $20 an hour and $5 in fringe, I'm going to do $25 in fringe, and now I don't have an overtime obligation.
Right. Okay, so that's the rule under the FLSA. So for the cash payment gets factored in to the base rate for purposes of bumping it up for overtime?
Yeah.
If it's not a cash payment, if it's just the extension of the fringe benefit,
then it's excluded under exclusion four or exclusion two, or, you know, there's a couple exclusions, but the two main ones here that track the list of fringe benefits in 7602 are two and four.
Okay. Then if you take that same set of questions and apply it to the SCA and under the SCA for employees that are subject to that regime, mm-hmm. then what's the result under your approach, speaking broadly as to the treatment of the in-kind fringe benefit versus the cash
right.
equivalent payment?
So they're treated identically, and they're both excluded from the overtime calculation. And the reason that doesn't present...
So they're treated differently than they are in the FSLA,
correct.
But they're treated identically to one another.
Correct. So that two employees under a Service Contract Act employer, you know, one may say, my spouse has better health insurance, I don't want yours, just give me the $550 an hour, which is what the regulation requires. Employee B says, no, I don't have other health insurance. I want the health insurance. On my friend's contrary interpretation,
they're not
the guy with the spouse who's got health insurance gets more overtime.
That's the result under the FLSA.
But under the FLSA, you're not statutorily required as an employer to give your employees benefits and to pay them cash if they reject the benefits. That's what motivates this.
That's the broad level question to me is, your regime would beget a different result than
yes.
under the FLSA.
Yes.
Your regime would also beget equivalence as between the cash payment and the extension of the fringe benefit. So then the question becomes, okay, then what is it in the SCA
Yes.
Tells me that we ought to treat the cash payment and the in-kind benefit the same under the SCA, even though we don't treat them the same under the FLSA.
So putting aside that that's what I think 7707E is doing, the right. reason for that is, number one, this is a federal requirement that is tightly regulated, right? The fringe and the wage, as I was saying before, there's a ceiling and a floor set on these. The federal government is ultimately paying for this itself. These are all reimbursement contracts. So the contract price is flowing back to the United States government. So by having consistency of application within the service contractor, you end up with a better ability for the government to predict what it's going to be paying on these contracts. It eliminates the competition amongst employers over the wages, which was kind of the point of the SCA, just to make sure that the wages are uniform across the board so that when two employers are bidding on a service contract, one is not getting the low price because it's shortchanging employees. By just taking wages out of the picture and tightly regulating it, then what they're competing on price is over the quality of the service and the other things that they do. And so I think that that's why Congress made this cash option here, which is unique, right?
In the SCA,
the cash option to discharge the fringe obligation is unique. And then said, because of its uniqueness and overall where this fits within the scheme, as DOL has said from the very beginning, it's just going to be excluded. We're just going to treat them as the same and take this off the table.
Now, the last question, and then you can switch to the other issue briefly. The last question is this. Is there a scenario in which, under your approach, when we're talking about the SCA, that there is a fringe benefit in kind that does get factored into the base rate and so gets bumped up, and therefore the cash equivalent also would?
I think the answer is possibly, and that's because the definition of fringe in 6702 has a catch-all, like, and other bona fide fringe benefits. The ones that are enumerated all before that map perfectly onto FLSA exemptions, but the catch-all is the catch-all. Like, it could be a lot of different things, and I can't really predict what might fit within the SCA's fringe catch-all and how any of those fringe would
because
or wouldn't
matter. It just seems to me that if your argument is under the SCA context, that they ought to be treated the same, that the cash
equivalent. And indeed, that is what the DOL has said. Exactly.
And it should go in both directions.
Correct.
It could also be that if an in-kind benefit does get factored into the base rate.
And that is exactly the DOL interpretation. Yep. When the in-kind comes within the exclusion, the cash equivalent also comes within the exclusion. That's all we're asking for. Correct.
Treating for equivalent treatment.
Correct. We're asking.
It's unequal treatment vis-a-vis the FLSA, but it's equivalent treatment.
As between
within
the SCA space.
Confines of the SCA. Okay.
That's exactly right, Chief Judge Srinivasan.
Okay.
Unless the court has questions, I've briefly addressed the other issue on preemption. And I want to be clear, I think, about what we're arguing on preemption, because my friend on the other side has accused us of making a much broader preemption argument at the end of the day. What we're saying is that a third party, which the employees are a third party to a government contract, cannot use state law to enforce wage payment provisions in that government contract, especially where the Department of Labor has been comprehensively empowered to enforce those very same provisions under the Service Contract Act. And as a result, I think there are three lines of column preemption cases that intersect in this particular spot. One is a line of cases, and this is why I hesitate to call them preemption, but that say where you're dealing with federal contracts and duties under federal contracts, that is an inherently federal area of law, like Texas Industries and Armstrong. And in that space, state law doesn't even get the benefit of the presumption against preemption. This is just federal. What the federal duties are, what someone owes to the federal government, is inherently subject to federal regulation. Second line of cases are those like this court's decision in Sickle that say where a state claim does not exist independently being the key words, of the federal rights or the federal requirements, or conversely, where the claim exists solely because of federal requirements, that also runs into a preemption.
Sorry, what case did you say?
Sickle, S-I-C-K-L-E, which we've cited in our briefs.
Okay.
And then the third line of cases are the ones that deal specifically with the SCA and find that the enforcement scheme for DOL is so comprehensive as to be exclusive of other methods of enforcement. Now, this court has considered that on several occasions, always in connection with someone attempting to enforce a provision under a federal cause of action, an implied right of action, Declaratory Judgment Act, and the like. And the court has rejected every single one of those on the ground that the SCA's enforcement provisions are so comprehensive that they imply a manifest, really, a congressional intent that that be the only means of enforcement.
Those are a little bit different.
They are a little bit different, but I think
presumption against preemption.
But I don't think you get to the presumption against preemption in a scenario where you're dealing with federal contracts and federal duties to begin with. That's Texas Industries, that's Armstrong.
That's your first point.
Correct.
So just to press on your second a little bit, suppose instead of just expressly incorporating the federal obligations, the state had just written out into its code book all the words in federal law and then said private right of action, four times the recovery. Preemption?
I think that would raise a different type of preemption analysis than, and frankly, a harder one than I need to win the issue here, because it would raise more of an financial impact.
That's my instinct, but on the other hand, it's a little weird that the legal result would change just because they use federal law as a shorthand.
Well, but this gets to a principle like I think the Supreme Court articulated in the Astra case, which we rely. That's a Medicaid contracting case. But there the court says that when the contract or the laws are really just
joined at the hip.
Exactly. Joined at the hip in an obvious way, then it seems like the court's going to put a little bit of a buffer around that to prevent states and others from interfering with the federal scheme. So I think in your honor's hypothetical, if we open up the DC law and it's just the latest wage determination copied and pasted with the, word DOL crossed out and, DC wage authority on top, I think I'd come in here and I'd make a preemption argument, right? But if it's just they enacted a law and set a minimum wage of $50 an hour for all employers in the city, well, at that point, I think we're dealing with a more attenuated effect on the federal interest. As I quickly wrap up then, I just want to hit that Astra is an important case for us. It cites, not just cites, it actually endorses the end run principle of Second Circuit in Gronkowski. And you mentioned the Wygod case with Mr. Eiler in the earlier part. Footnote 19 in Wygod is an important one because in that decision, which came, I think, just on the heels of Astra, it seemed like the court was unhappy with Gronkowski. But Justice Ginsburg's decision for the court in Astra embraces the rationale. And the way the Seventh Circuit dealt with this then in footnote 19 was to say that Astra and that principle and the Gronkowski principle apply essentially preemption where the plaintiff is a third party to the contract. But in the Wygod case, and it's the very final part of the footnote, the dealing with the HAMP mortgages, the court said that that the party was itself, the plaintiff was itself the party to the contract sought to be enforced. And so Judge Katz says, I think what the problem was after Gronkowski, a lot of defendants tried to take this end run principle, which really is focused on the contractual relationship between the government and a private individual, and then use it to defend against their own personal contracts, employment agreements, and other contracts with plaintiffs.
Do you recall in Astra, did the plaintiff try to do the end run through a contract theory? Was this
through various state law court claims?
Was the plaintiff invoking state law or federal common law?
State law, primarily. And that's very clear in the Ninth Circuit decision that was under review. The Supreme Court didn't really talk about it, but there were three or four different state law causes of action.
Whatever happened to, I think this is in the restatement of contracts, the whole line of cases where a third party beneficiary can sue when there are benefit, when they are
an intended beneficiary. Yeah.
Yeah.
The more recent, some cases, I think Armstrong from the U.S. Supreme Court and Astra very clearly disagree that you can find an intended beneficiary in federal contracts. in quite the same way that you would, say, in a private contract space. So as a matter of federal statutory interpretation in federal common law, as has come up in some cases, the Supreme Court's teachings, as I understand them, are that we're very skeptical of these third-party beneficiary claims because they end up being end runs around our rules against implied rights of action. I've overstayed my welcome, but
I have one last technical question on the back on the other issue,
okay,
which is this, that where we left it off at the end is that under your approach, which is the DOL historical approach, the in-kind fringe benefit and the cash equivalent get treated the same. So in maybe the rare instance in which the in-kind does get factored in for overtime purposes, the cash equivalent would too. The district court, I understood the district court to be concluding that the cash payment never gets factored in. Period.
There are a couple sentence statements. I think that could be read that way. But I take that in connection with the fact that the in-kind benefits here are just ordinary health and welfare benefits. So they're not the
they
sort.
They don't factor in.
Exactly.
So you think there's there would be if the court were to reach that conclusion, and I'm not predicting where the court will go, but you think that there would be no reason to
remand? No, not in this case, because the particular in-kind
particular case,
base,
the in-kind are out.
Exactly so right. They're all within exception four. All right. Well, for those reasons, Your Honor, we ask that the judgment below be affirmed in its entirety. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Eiler, we'll give you 4 minutes for rebuttal since we went on for a while.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I could decipher my chicken scratch. You know, Your Honors, I think a moment should be talked about the purpose of Section 6707E. I think that might be a good place to sort of start here. I think that Solicitor Donahue in some of the congressional hearings that were referenced by Judge Randolph made clear that the purpose of Section 6707E is for consistency in the treatment of overtime between, I believe it's the three statutes. Well, there's a quote that we had cited to in our reply brief on brief indulgence, Your Honor. Well, there is a quotation I know that we had cited to in our reply brief, Your Honor, regarding what Solicitor Donahue told Congress, which was that the purpose of Section 6707E is for the treatment of consistency between these three statutes. He was referencing other statutes relating to federal contracts that govern overtime, like the CWHSSA, I believe is the statutory statute for overtime under federal contracts. I think that the purpose that is being forwarded by my colleagues on the other side of sort of this highly regulated structure meant to enhance competition or eliminate competition is not the purpose. It's a simpler purpose. And, you know, Your Honors, that purpose is just consistency. There's no reason to treat an employee in a private entity different than the employee of a private contract or a public contractor. And my recollection of either the Ramahi case or the Garcia case is that there was a note that it would be somewhat odd for Congress to have provided less rights for employees of public contractors than for employees of private entities. That's just a bit to talk about the purpose of 6707E, as well as, Your Honors, there's a lot of space, decades, in fact, between the FLSA and the passage of the SCA, I think more than 30 years or so, which is something that I think should be considered when we're talking about, well, it's completely superfluous. Why is 6707E exist in the first place if everyone's just going to do what the FLSA says to begin with? And I think, as Judge Randolph noted, there was some controversy about whether or not the FLSA, in fact, applied to these class of employees. That's just to state a note on the purpose of 6707E. Consistency. You know, on the issue of preemption or preclusion or end run, I think it's a very simple question. Is there something about the SCA that disables the state law claims? You know, it's interesting because the D.C. Minimum Wage Act, in fact, sets the minimum wage for security officers protecting public buildings in the district to match one to one the Service Contract Act security officer. And this is just an anecdote to say there's nothing disabling about tying a right or remedy to something extraneous like the SCA, a publicly accessible at sam.gov, where these wage determinations become effective upon publication. You can go, you can look up what the rate is, and that is the rate that you are to be paid. And that is what the health and welfare rate is, what you're supposed to receive. The idea that, and I think I heard Astra, those were predominantly, and Gronkowski, those are predominantly contract claims. We are not asserting a third-party beneficiary case in this case. We're not suing under the SCA like what they did in Hodgson. We're suing under the D.C. law for the collection of these specific wage rates set by the Department of Labor, which have become effective, which are known, and which should have been paid, and they weren't.
How do you distinguish Astra on this point?
Well, Your Honor, on this point, I know from Astra there is that small citation to Gronkowski, which notes that where there is a statute and a, and I believe it, Gronkowski truly was a breach of contract action. The FLSA claim in Gronkowski was permitted to go through. And I thought it was interesting as well. And I think it's better to maybe talk about Astra's endorsement of Gronkowski, because I think that's really what the value to appellees that Astra provides. What I also found was interesting was Gronkowski did not disturb its prior holding, the Second Circuit's prior holding in Chan, that a Section 1983 action would be permitted on a Davis-Bacon Act claim. It makes me question if there is a sufficiently comprehensive remedial structure, how can there be a Section 1983 claim? And I think the answer to that question is that there isn't one. That's how I would maybe distinguish Astra, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you. If you want to wrap up really quickly, you can. But
Your Honor, all we would ask is that the matter be reversed and remanded in its entirety. There is no preclusive effect. There is no end run being committed. And ultimately, the overtime, the interpretation that we forwarded below is the commanding majority interpretation. And as well, Your Honors, it's, I would say, the plain reading, and if not, it's the best reading. So we'd ask to be reversed and remanded in entirety. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. We'll take this case under submission.